Yoga is the shift of consciousness from a state of complexity and complication and conflict to one of simplicity and silence and stillness. Have you made that shift? Have you become yogis? This is the essence of practice. We'll continue with the words of Tulku Orgyen Rinpoche from Vajra Speech. We are on a section called Openness. Complete openness means not being attached to anything, not fixating on anything. This is precisely the opposite of an ordinary person's frame of mind, because the ordinary person clings to and fixates on everything. The openness of a yogi does not fixate on anything and does not hold on to anything. The moment the event happens and it's past, it's gone. The yogi doesn't think about it. The yogi stays in the present moment continually, always letting go. No trace of the past remains. The world is always new. It is always the first moment of creation. There is no trace of karma. No baggage is carried by a yogi. So, we need to grow used to this type of openness. Let your five senses be wide open, wide awake, and yet free of thoughts. Remain in that state, utterly open. So, he is saying this is not just for when you sit and meditate, but to remain in that state always, in utter openness and in the present moment. No concern about past or future. Nothing going on in the mind, no chatter. Openness of consciousness, openness of heart, openness to all that occurs. Non-dual awareness is primordially open and free. So, the state that he's talking about of openness is also a state of non-duality. It means there is no bifurcation of subject and object. As soon as there is the bifurcation of subject and object, there is closedness, because the other is closed out. There is a separation and an alienation from reality. So openness means you're not a subject, because that means you're defined and closed in an identity, and you put everyone else into a pigeonhole of a projection. So openness means non-duality. This openness is naturally free. However, this openness becomes bound by the rope of conceptual mind when a sentient being is fettered by conceptual thoughts in a body of karmic ripening. It seems then to lose its natural freedom. So, very interesting concept. As soon as you tie your consciousness to the rope of a concept, a belief, a frame of reference, then you have put yourself into not only identification with the physical body, but the karmic body. Karma will happen. It will ripen. There will be consequences to your loss of freedom. It will bring suffering. And you will have brought it on yourself by having given away your freedom in order to hold on to a concept. And the first concept, of course, is the concept of I. So the yogi lets go of the concept that one is an ego, a bodily being in a world, and then there is freedom. The sentient being wants to hold on to the ego and get rid of its karmic suffering, but you can't have it both ways. If you're an ego, karma will ripen, consequences will happen, suffering will ensue. Only by the letting go of the concept that begins with the I thought is their freedom. So the awakened state is wide open. Nothing is fixated upon or held onto, like the ocean in which no sediment remains. So sediment means past beliefs, assumptions, old concepts that you apply to the new so that the new cannot be seen as it is but will always be seen as a repetition of the old. And the ego does this to hold on to a sense of familiarity and control. But it's at the expense of being alive, open to the present, and able to see what is new and what is real in any situation. And one is then stuck with one's projections. So it should be clear to everyone then what yoga is and what must be let go of in order to be free. Now, he goes into the next section called Ordinary Mind to explain how you get there. And it can't be any simpler because, he says, there is no need to do anything. To your present wakefulness, at the moment of recognizing, it is already as it is. So the moment you recognize that what you are is simply wakeful presence, without concepts, without ideas, without emotions, but simply openness to the present, that's what you are. That's consciousness in its pure state, without acquisitions of baggage. As soon as you recognize that, you're already free. Liberation is instantaneous, not something that has to be accomplished. This is the true meaning of naked ordinary mind, a famous term in Tibetan. It means the consciousness that has not been tampered with. There is no thing which needs to be either accepted or rejected. All is simply as it is. The term ordinary mind is the most immediate and accurate term to describe the nature of consciousness. In other words, it's not an altered state. It's not something you have to conjure up or fabricate. It's not something that needs to be developed. It is always present. Present the moment you're born. In fact, even before birth, the ordinary mind is our true nature. So, no matter what terminology is being utilized, naked ordinary mind is the simplest term. The present moment of unfabricated wakefulness is seen the moment we look. Sometimes it's called present mind, ordinary mind, or naked mind. Ordinary mind means that it is neither something worse or something improved. It means that unceasing wakefulness is present in all beings, down to the tiniest insect. This unceasing wakefulness is our true nature. So there is nothing to do, nothing to accomplish. No effort is either required or, in fact, helpful, because any effort you make will take you away from ordinary mind. But for the ego, the hardest thing is to do nothing and to just be. But it's that simple being present that is liberation itself. So he goes on in the next section to talk about the path. Right now, among the ground, the original nature, the path to get back to our original nature and the fruition, we are at the path stage. Now, of course, what he just told us in the previous section is there actually is no path. And you never left the ground. And the fruition is nothing other than the ground. So although it's divided into these three levels for the sake of students who don't get what simplicity is because they're too complicated, nonetheless, there is actually no difference between these three levels. The path is pathless. It's simply being present. There is no other path. And the fruition is just being present. So the path is simply a set of exercises given to help someone become more simple and more present from being lost in their head and in mental chatter that they can't stop for one reason or another. So he says, actually, awareness itself is without anything to be cultivated. There's no learning involved. You don't need to read anything. You don't need to understand some subtle, complex concept, quite the opposite. You need to recognize that you are always already primordially free awareness. Right now, at this instant, you are primordially free awareness. All you need to do is not cover that over with thinking and with emotions and projections. Just stay present and you're done. There's no long path to go through. So, but if you don't recognize that this is your nature, then you are simply a sentient being with karma. You need to recognize this primordially free awareness. This is the beginning of the path of yoga and of becoming enlightened. Primordially free awareness is present already within the mind stream of all sentient beings, but they do not recognize it. Only the yogi recognizes the inherent truth, because it's always covered over by thoughts in the ego mind. The ego never stops thinking long enough to realize that its real nature is just presence. But if you practice realizing the presence and how peaceful it is and how free and how open and how much joy there is, you won't go back into chatter and into a closed-minded consciousness. Appearances of form are the nature of the deity's body. All sounds are the nature of their speech. All thoughts are the nature of the deity's mind, deities in plural. These acknowledgments are the three things to carry concerning sights, sounds, and awareness. To carry means to bring on to the path, not to abandon. So when he uses this term, the deity's minds and the deity's speech and body, what he's saying is that the world is alive, the world is magical, the world is divine, your senses are divine. Everything is an incarnation of a divine being. So it's a kind of pantheism. Everything is alive, animated, and intelligent. Even things that seem inanimate have intelligence. So once you recognize that, there is far more respect for what you took for granted as simply a world of matter. There's no such thing. It's all alive. And everything has its own intelligence. But it's also true that he's saying panentheism, because all of these living deities are within the one Buddha mind. So, and the one Buddha mind ultimately is transcendent of all of the multiplicity as well. So at some point there is no world. At another point there's a world that's alive with gods and goddesses. And at another point the Buddha mind is all that is real. So he says, Buddhahood, the realized state of all awakened beings, does not stray back to the path of confusion due to having recognized the state of the ground as being pure gold. In other words, it's so priceless, so precious, so amazingly miraculous to reach the Buddha nature that once you do, you won't go back to the fool's gold of ego consciousness. But our pure gold, as long as there is an ego, is covered with mud due to its confusion. Thus, we have entered the path to eliminate confusion. But until it is eliminated, do not underestimate the power of confusion to divert you from the path, make you forget the path, take you into Maya and more suffering, and feel that the path is hopeless. But realize all of that is a delusion of the ego that doesn't want to dissolve in the Buddha mind. Perseverance, he says, in the context of recognizing mind essence, should be like the unbroken flow of a river. Is there ever any second when the Ganges does not flow? It is steady, unbroken, a completely unrelenting current of energy. It never stops. It's never interrupted. No one is pushing it or pulling it down the riverbed. It simply flows. Of course, there may be a difference in volume or intensity as to how much water is passing through, but the flow is never interrupted. So, he's saying, don't let the flow of the current of your life energy, your shakti, and your prana, both, the life energy of the body and the life energy of the spirit, which are ultimately a single whole but at different levels of intensity, don't ever interrupt that current. But every time you create a thought, you interrupt the flow of the energy. It flows when the mind is silent, and it is dammed up when the mind is chattering. So don't be dammed. Be free. Be in a flow state. Be in silent presence. He uses another analogy now, and he says, another example is the constancy of a bowstring. Once you bend the bow and make the string taut, it doesn't sometimes become tight and sometimes become slack. It stays at an even tension. we must have the same kind of perseverance and steadiness, so we do not alternate between sometimes struggling and pushing ourselves hard and other times just giving up, but always be in the flow of egoless presence that doesn't strive and doesn't fall into despair. How is it possible to exert oneself without fluctuation? By training in undistracted non-meditation. Okay? Non-meditation because there's no ego doing it, and there's nothing to do because it's only being. And it's being undistracted from the present moment. Let's practice. Namaste. How many remained undistracted? Yeah, completely? No thoughts? Anyone? How many felt you made progress by practicing this way? Yes? Okay. Does anyone have any question about any of this?
Thank you, Shunya. Something I got out of this, which is
a little louder.
Key for me, is that you're always primordially free awareness and trying not to fixate on that. I am able to stay in that until a certain point. There is still a lot of mud, a lot of suffering in the body. So how to connect the two when that point where the stillness is no longer able to be held?
What does the suffering consist in? How do you know there is suffering in the body?
The belief in what you've just said in this teaching about that there is still an ego to eliminate.
Mm-hmm. But how does it come up when you're in silent presence? Do you have a pain in the body? What happens that comes into your consciousness?
The disgraceful thoughts, if I was to be honest.
Mm-hmm. All right. So it's thoughts. It's not in the body. It's in the mind. So don't confuse it. It's all in the mind. Even if it seems to arise from the body, it doesn't. It comes from consciousness. And it's a choice to think those thoughts. So as soon as you see it arise, you realize it's not your thought. It's simply a karmic trace of the ego, but you're not the ego. You are the awareness. Simply by returning to the awareness, that karma is released, and there is no more suffering, because the past is an illusion. It doesn't exist, except as that thought. And so as you witness the thought without judgment, without calling it disgraceful, just see the thought, realize it's not true, it's an interruption in your Buddha mind, in your presence of joy and love and bliss, and let it go immediately and return to silence, and soon you will find that no more of those disturbing thoughts will arise. So you keep practicing without any feeling like, oh, not again, or any sense of failure. Just keep going, and you will see that the tide will turn and the ocean of consciousness will remain without waves at some point, and no more disturbance will interrupt. Okay?
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Okay? You want to bring the mic?
Well, my question has to do with silence.
Ah.
Because you can speak from silence, right?
Silence is speech. It's the real speech.
Yes.
It's absolute speech.
Yes. Yes, I just had that understanding that being in silence doesn't mean that you cannot speak. When you have the inner silence.
It is the silence itself that must speak, not an ego that's speaking. Otherwise, you're not in silence. That's a chattering mind. But if the silence itself has something to offer into a situation from that place of non-dual awareness, then it is absolute speech. And it doesn't interrupt the silence at all.
But words can also come from silence.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. There will be times when the silence will be accompanied but not interrupted by speech. Like Sri Ramana would speak whenever he was asked a question. Well, not always. Sometimes he didn't answer the question. But when speech came out, it didn't interrupt the state of silence. But it's because the ego was already gone and the silence was one's consciousness. You see, something extraordinary happens when you remain in silence for a long enough period. The ego illusion dissolves and all that remains is this very intense power of consciousness that is light and that is energy and has many different ways of appearing. But there is no longer the ego mind. It's a field of consciousness. So that field then includes everything that is perceived within the field. And whenever there is an action required in the field, it will happen without interrupting the field itself, which remains undisturbed. And because that's what you are, there's no ego in the field any longer. The silence is never broken, even when words are spoken by the body. Okay?
Thank you.
And you wanted to take a vow of silence, correct?
Yes,
of external silence. So it is official. Nirmala is in silence. Don't anyone go up to her and disturb her external silence so that she can also be in the inner silence. Is that helpful?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you so much. I found the practice really useful, even though there were so many thoughts, I just had to laugh at how not silent it was. But I think it was better than kind of beating myself up for it and saying, why can't I be silent? What's kind of wrong? One of the questions that came up in my non-silent meditation was the relationship between the magic of the deities and simplicity. Because I think the interrupter of the silence is this kind of impulse towards, I think you called it the magic of nature, but the magic of life, kind of trying to in my mind, imagining it or approaching it or experiencing life, but through the mind, which doesn't make any sense, but that is what is interrupting the silence and the simplicity.
Mm-hmm. So okay, but that's not the magic of nature.
Right.
That's the lack of magic in the mind that feels its lack and wants magic, but feels like it doesn't have it. So, and there is no self that doesn't have it. That's the illusion. So the more that you stay in the awareness of this non-magical mind that is striving to become magical, the more you realize you are already the magic itself. And the magic puts a trance onto that mind and dissolves it. That's the first magic. Okay? You eliminate the illusion that there's someone thinking and trying to meditate and failing and getting caught up in whatever other imaginary ideas. Remain free of that by witnessing it until the tendency to fall into that illusion is extinguished.
And that's the simplicity, is just the awareness. Right.
The simplicity is always there, but covered over by this complicated ego mind.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Shun. Mm-hmm. I found the metaphor or the analogy of the river helpful, I think. Mm-hmm. I feel like, I don't know what the word is, berated, or like just lots of thoughts constantly. And when I sit and try to be silent, mm-hmm. like it's just constant. And so I felt like, and I maybe just made another thought on top of it, but I felt like trying to imagine being a river and just all these thoughts coming up, but just let them go, right?
Let them flow down the river.
Right, but then I'm like, well, where are they going, you know? And then they're going to the ocean, and then I was like, oh, but the ocean doesn't stop either, mm-hmm. you know, right? If you have stagnation, that's not good. But
that's a judgment. Just let them go. Okay. Don't worry about it. The ocean will take care of itself.
Okay. I'm like polluting the ocean, okay?
The ocean will biodegrade the thoughts and they'll disappear. Not to worry. You'll feed a few fish, that's all.
But I guess I feel like was in the beginning of what you read, not being fixated on the past. And I feel like I'm constantly clogged by feeling like the past, even a week ago or yesterday, you know, 5 minutes ago, is affecting the future. So it feels like this very mind, you know, out of my, very much like out of my frame of reference, deal with that. But I feel like maybe in the same way, just letting it flow or whatever. But then, so the last point was that when I sit here and I try to tune more to that, like my heart starts racing and all, you know, I don't know. And it's just...
Okay. The ego is an apparatus that wants to continue producing those thoughts, and it only lives in the past, and it's only worried about the future. It is never present, okay? And the ego cannot be present, because that's what the ego is actually a defense against presence. Because at some point early in life, being present was unbearably painful. So the ego decided, I will just be in the past and in the future and not in the present. But what it did by doing that is to just simply freeze its pain, its traumas, as if they are present. So the ego will bring the traumas up as disgraceful thoughts, as horrible suffering, as worry about the future, as creating more suffering. That's all it will do, is awfulize and catastrophize. The ego can't do anything but that. But it's an apparatus that has no reality to it, and it is not conscious. It's only when your consciousness identifies with it that it seems to come to life and to be you, but it's not. And as soon as you extract your consciousness from it, witness it without identifying, the heart will stop racing and there will be peace, and that apparatus will no longer be relevant to you, and it will be dropped into the river and let go, and it will be gone. So don't identify with this thinking apparatus. It's very simple. And the more you do that, when the apparatus starts to interrupt your presence and your flow, the more that you just return to the flow instantly, soon it won't be able to interrupt you anymore, and its tendency will be eliminated. Okay? Trust the process and keep flowing. That's all. Okay, anyone else? Okay, Urvashi.
In the teaching last night, you said that the karma of the body is predetermined, but it's how we deal with it that counts. And I was wondering if that applies to symptoms, because I feel even when there's not thoughts coming in and there's more presence, there'll be symptoms, like pains and things in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And is it just a matter of completely ignoring it because it's like burning and stabbing and all these different things? Is it just a matter of, if it's very distracting, more distracting than thoughts. I know it is thoughts.
It is thoughts, that's right. So now that you know that it's thoughts, and it's simply the residue of past traumas that have been somatized because they were unbearable, once you stop identifying with them and realize you're not the body, and this didn't happen to you, it happened only to the body and the ego apparatus, but not to you. You are unborn and deathless and untouched by that pain and those traumas. You can witness it, and as the pain comes up, you can release it. Just let it go without thinking about it, without worrying, without being hurt by it. Having no judgment and no reaction, it will dissipate. It's only there to try to bring you back into the past, into the trauma, into the whole ego complex. Once you refuse to go back into it, the pain will leave. It has no ability to stay except your belief that you're carrying a lot of pain. When that belief ends, the pain ends, okay? All right. Okay. Marjiva.
So it's this beautiful surprise to be in satsang with you today. And what I was noticing in the meditation practice, also what caught my attention was your reading from the joy of life, the magic of life, which I sense ever more is that joy of surprise and synchronicity, which... It's not total silence yet, but there is this current now. And when you were speaking about how the ego avoided presence early on in order to escape from those unwanted surprises, which were the reverse, right? So what I was noticing was this natural coming in here, seeing you here, not knowing you were going to be here, and feeling so joyful with that surprise. And then I was aware, okay, you know, just the flow was natural, and there were synchronicities happening through my morning with what you were reading as well. And then I could tell how there would be these fragments of the ego tape that would go, now, you know, we could say, but why are people here who are never here during meditation, and I wasn't told?
Of course.
Yeah. And there was, and they would just kind of just arise for a moment. Go flow down the river. No interest in that. So I guess I want to express is this transitional period that I find I'm in of just ever more disconnecting from the tape of what the ego would say to just the joy of accepting everything as it is, and being awe and just grateful for everything, no matter what it is. And so that's what I really could tell in my meditation. It was hardly disturbed, by any of the thoughts I would likely have. It would have been really devastating, just who knows when. So the synchronicity of providing this opportunity to practice. And that way of the swaraja, ego doesn't take over. And the joy remains, and the gratitude, and the learning, and the practice.
Beautiful. I think you hit on the key point of practice, which is that of total acceptance of everything that occurs or doesn't occur, and all the surprises, good and bad, and to be able to accept it all without reacting, and without having judgments, and just not letting your flow of joy be disturbed. So, beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did you have, let Ashoka have the mic? Wow. Okay. We have a new volunteer here.
Yeah, there's something around here.
So I have a question. Is silence always followed by an increase in prana and shakti?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right.
Yeah, because what you're doing is accumulating shakti. When you're silent, when you're thinking or speaking or involved in any maya, whatever, emotions, you're discharging energy, you're losing energy. And when you're being silent, you're accumulating it. And you're accumulating energy, you're accumulating peace, you're accumulating intelligence, because it grows. The more silent you are, the more expanded your consciousness is, and the more attuned you are to infinite mind. So everything grows, and especially the ecstatic state grows. And once you have really expanded it wide, then nothing will take it away. Your battery is so charged that it will remain in silence even in a chaotic situation. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I think on that note, we will end this little mini satsang and let you have lunch. But I'm glad that it was an experience that you could enjoy and practice the undisturbed state of non-meditation. So I hope that the same practice happens while you're eating lunch. And instead of getting caught in small talk and deviation from presence, that you remain in that state of unbroken presence until the river becomes one with the ocean of consciousness. And there is no one left even to do non-meditation. It's all just an infinite field of bliss that is never disturbed. And no matter what seems to be occurring in this illusory phenomenal hologram, all of it is just made of light and made of bliss, and you are that. So blessings to you all. Namaste. Namaste.